But it was interesting talking to the ones from the tech companies. And I asked them, I said, blockchain, dead or alive, right? And this, and they were like, very much dead. Don't ever bring that up in the boardroom. It's like uninvestable at the moment. But that's the time when you can really make progress, because like the eyes aren't on it as much. So the people that are really building, you know, have time to like, you know, not be pushed around by investors to deliver value immediately.
Today, I'm speaking with Michael Barron. Michael is a partner at Pfizer Ventures, where he invests in various biopharma companies. Earlier this year, he led Pfizer's investment into VidaDAO, and he continues to be actively involved in decentralized science. Among other things, we discuss misconceptions about big biopharma, how to measure DeSci success, and predecessors to the DeSci structure. Without further ado, I hope you enjoy our conversation. So, Michael, thanks so much for taking your time to speak today.
Yeah, happy to be here.
To start off, what to you as a biotech VC especially is the strong case for DeSci?
Oh, well, that's I guess that's a long question, long answer to a simple question. But to simplify it, I guess, I think when I think of biotech venture investing, I'm thinking more closer to being in clinical studies. So Series A kind of type financings that get you to like, usually they start around year within 2 years of getting into humans. The DeSci I think of right now as being for earlier stage, right? We talk about valley of death often, right? And that's shortly, in a short way to say that is kind of translating some of the science that's coming out of academia into, you know, early stage biotech companies and just kind of de-risking the idea. So I think that's the sweet spot for the moment for DeSci. And it has to do with the amount of capital that, you know, you can raise in a DAO. Most DeSci companies or operations are probably not company isn't probably the best word, but most of them are, you know, governed via DAO. And DAO treasuries, I'd say today, can be somewhere along the lines of, you know, $5 to $30 million in size. And so if that's the pot of money you have to work with, you know, the check sizes are going to be sub 1 million, which is fine for seed stage, but that's why, you know, that's the sweet spot. And that's what attracted me to that space, is there just isn't enough capital to support all of the ideas that are coming out of academia. So more shots on goal we can get, you know, the higher the chance we have of finding a breakthrough.
Yeah. And are there any advantages to DeSci over traditional biotech that you have actually found has been traditionally underplayed, or traditionally meaning, you know, in the past few years of it even being a thing? Is there like anything that you feel like has been overplayed conversely?
Well, I think in traditional venture capital, like Series A and beyond, there's more capital than there is quality opportunities often, right? Now it's like a little tight, right? But still, like if you have like something promising, like you're going to get some solid investors around the table that are going to, you know, fund that science. In the earlier stage, it's the opposite, right? There isn't enough capital to pursue all the ideas. And so, you know, I think that's where DeSci becomes interesting, because, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, it's an alternative source of capital, right? You're tapping into these token holders via DAO. The governance is also another thing I think that is synergistic with that. So the network effect that you get out of a DAO means you have good reach in terms of, you know, who's participating. So VidaDAO, for example, that's the one that Pfizer participates in, and myself personally. And so, you know, there's about 10,000 members in VidaDAO now. So compare that to a traditional venture fund that has 7 people or 10 people in it. You know, your scope is just so much greater, right? So VidaDAO, we have no problem sourcing opportunities and finding smart people to help diligence them. And that's another benefit, I think.
Yeah. And as I understand it, you've been with Pfizer for like a decade and a half now.
Yeah, like that. 15 years, decade and a half.
Prior to kind of the rise of DeSci, have you encountered ideas that resembled at least elements of what Vida is doing now? Are there surprising predecessors that we might not be aware of? And so what might have been like their weaknesses? What can we learn from the past?
Yeah. Well, I think today, like the comp that I always use to say this is essentially what we're doing here at DeSci is the accelerator model. So the accelerator model, like lots of traditional venture groups invest in them. Pfizer Ventures has participated in a few. Usually they're organized around a specific area, just like DeSci DAOs. So we participated in two in particular. One was called Cydan. It was in Boston, and they focused on rare disease. The other one was called the New York Accelerator, and it was more like a geography focus, so trying to fund science coming out of New York City. But then under the hood, the way they worked is a little bit different, right? So instead of having a DAO and tokens, you have like a corporate entity, like a C corp or an LLC, and you have, traditional equity. Investors buy equity, and then that's, how you generate the equivalent of what we call the treasury in the DeSci world, and you use the treasury to spin out companies. So that's the equivalent that I always use as an example. As far as learnings, I think we're writing the chapter on if we have something unique here, writing the next chapter in the book. Because what's different then is the whole governance. So traditional accelerator model functions like a hierarchical company, with a board of directors, a C-suite management team, and below. Again, not like a huge team because you want to use most of the capital allocation to fund the companies that you're investing in and starting. So small team, small reach, versus DAO, huge network effect, larger reach, more people having say and ownership in decision making. So that's the hypothesis is that that's better and you'll be able to find better ideas. We'll see. We'll see. There's nice examples on the accelerator side of, some companies that have graduated and gone on to raise, big rounds out of those models.
About the bringing science to New York, actually, was that a success overall too, would you say? Or were there interesting challenges?
Yeah,
'Cause
no,
you're
I mean, we
both.
started a few companies. Some got acquired by some public companies that would be familiar if I mentioned them specifically. So yeah, I would say success. So that whole accelerator, it was called New York Accelerator. Now we just call it Accelerator. They've moved on now, and they're focusing, I think, on Seattle at the moment. But as far as like when the New York fund was running, I would call it a success.
And among you and your colleagues, and maybe even partners at other big biopharma companies, what's been the to you strongest critique of DeSci so far related? What do you think colleagues might get wrong about DeSci?
Crypto.
Oh.
So yeah, so that's the big thing. When we first came across the model, crypto was AI, right? In terms of the thing, like the hot thing that everyone was interested in. And I think a lot of damage has been done to the credibility of the field in general with, I don't have to name all the events, but FTX, is the one in the news now with the court case going on. Just tremendously damaging to the point where I think it's toxic almost to mention investing in crypto. I was at a conference last week called it was called Global Corporate Venture Inc. So it's Pfizer Ventures is a corporate venture capital group, right? So this conference is for other corporate venture capitalists, not just from pharma, from all industries around the world, really, right? So I met people from tech, from people that had been at like Qualcomm and Cisco, and people from Booz Allen, and just people, just all sorts of industries. But we all have the same problems. But it was interesting talking to the ones from the tech companies. And I asked them, I said, blockchain, dead or alive, right? And this, and they were like, very much dead. Don't ever bring that up in the boardroom. It's like uninvestable at the moment. But that's the time when you can really make progress because like the eyes aren't on it as much. So the people that are really building, have time to like, not be pushed around by investors to deliver value immediately. And I think that's what we're seeing now with DeSci. So DeSci, for the most part today, is built over Ethereum, right? Ethereum's blockchain network, right, with programmability features to it. But what's the use case, right? I mean, Ethereum is just infrastructure, right? So what are you going to build on top of that infrastructure? And I think we saw DeFi, right? It was kind of like the first kind of go around of where an industry could, pop up using Ethereum. it's still pretty interesting, but you know, there's a lot of uncertainty around how that's all going to play out with, you know, regulatory agencies and with all the fraud that happened. You know, financial security, I guess, is like just all eyes are on that space and trying to tighten it up. So what comes next? And I brought up actually at the GCV event, the Global Corporate Venturing event, I described VitaDAO a little bit. And some of the tech guys were like, wow, you know, that's actually like a real legit use case. So you have this situation now where people have extreme antibodies, investors have extreme antibodies to investing in blockchain or anything that you can kind of, you know, correlate to crypto in some way. But on the flip side of that is we are, you know, one of the, you know, remaining groups that are working to actually build something with utility. And, you know, I think this is a strong use case and that's why we're here. And so, you know, we continue to be engaged with VitaDAO and help build VitaDAO.
Yeah. On the side of, and I've heard you briefly discuss this in other contexts too, but I wanted to talk more about quantification within DeSci and how one might measure success. How you think about this, obviously, as someone who has pushed for investing in this with like the like support of a big corporation, how were you kind of articulating what benchmarks would look like?
Yeah, we just need to have things that are funded by DAOs go on to attract traditional venture capital for now. At some point, a DeSci DAO may grow big enough where they can play alongside traditional venture capital. But right now, you know, you're just not going to be able to write like a $10, $20 million check. So to be realistic, right, something that graduates into real venture capital and you catch the eyes of the VC community, and they say, wow, you know, we should actually keep an eye on what's happening in the DAOs. There could be some interesting science, and they're you know, committing dollars to it and de-risking it. That should be more like the place where we pick ideas from. It can complement, you know, the traditional path of, you know, talking to the prominent academics and trying to spin companies out with them or their postdocs. And then likewise, you know, pharma also monitors the same crowd for ideas, and hopefully DeSci and DAOs become another source of deal flow. And that's exactly how I pitched it in Pfizer for us to kind of get comfortable is this is another source of deal flow, right? My primary interest was just in the model itself, right? In the whole DeSci model. VitaDAO happened to be the most mature DAO and focusing on longevity. At the time within Pfizer, we were talking about maybe creating like even a research unit around longevity. So the timing wise, it mapped up nicely because I was able to say access to deal flow, but specifically in this longevity space, which is new to us. We want to learn more about it. Great place to meet, you know, entrepreneurs, investors, the academics that are involved, VCs, like just the whole crowd in longevity is a little bit different than in the, you know, traditional venture biotech world.
Yeah. Within big biopharma yourself, how would you categorize the things that people are generally scared to work on? Is there anything common to the kinds of things that people are scared to go to?
You mean like in terms of
areas, research projects, even like just certain like things that are kind of left.
Okay, so you're not talking about like crypto in particular. You're talking more
no,
science.
No.
Well, I mean, just to be general, I would say early stage science is really hard to get people on board.
Yeah.
For just because it's just so risky. You literally, like, this is a real number. The chance of a preclinical project at the stage a DAO is investing, which is like, you know, probably 4 years plus from even going into humans, maybe even more than that. The chance of that becoming an approved product is less than 1%. And that's if you just take the success rates of what's the success of going from, you know, an idea to a clinical candidate into the clinic, phase one to phase two to phase three, approval. I mean, registration to approval. You just, you know, you multiply all those probabilities, which individually are low by themselves. You multiply those all together, you get less than 1%. So how do you get someone comfortable with an idea without even any animal data, right? And if you happen to generate some animal data, which is probably like the outcome of most of our DeSci investments, we'll get to generate animal data and have some like early tool compounds. Even that, like nobody really trusts animal data so much. It's not very predictive. I mean, and that's the path that projects take to become drugs. But even at that stage, even if you can get to like, we have a molecule that's pretty close to being ready to, that we can put into the clinic through DAO, you can get up to like maybe close to a 10% chance that that will be a product one day and generate some revenues. So it's just that's the problem, and that's why we need more money in the space, and that's why it's great that the DAOs open up an alternative pool of capital.
And to stay on the biopharma thread itself, if you could do away with one misconception that biopharma kind of is surrounded by, that you've either found repeated by friends, public, or other industries, what would that be?
Yeah, it's that pharma isn't is not innovative and buys everything from biotech companies. I mean, I hear it all the time from my DeSci friends now. Oh my God, I can't believe Pfizer did this. How could you? Oh, sorry. Did you hear that? I don't know if you.
No,
Okay, there's
we're
like a
all good.
calendar in my chair. Yeah, I hear that all the time, and it's a little bit frustrating because, well, A, if you just look at some numbers around like drugs that are approved and if they came from inside pharma or were acquired, it's I mean it's a little different for each company, and some pharma companies have like a strategy to just buy their way into markets. But for Pfizer at least, it's about 50-50. And then beyond that, just in terms of our external R&D strategy, we do a lot of innovative things in the way we interact with academics and try to kind of get closer to science that's outside our walls. So I think that's the biggest misconception.
Yeah. To possibly pull on the thread, what are some models that Pfizer's either created or adapted for partnering with both academia and startups? What have you found to be maybe the difficulties or bottlenecks with each of these models?
Yeah, I think, well, okay, so if you just walk backwards, right, you have the traditional methods, like, well, actually, was your question was just partnering external in general, right? Not with academia, or did you say with academia?
With academia as well,
Yeah, okay,
academia
but
or
everything,
startup.
right? So, okay, so if you walk backwards, you have like mature biotech companies. That's all the stuff that's been around forever, right? You either buy them, M&A, license something from them, have a research collaboration. But then as you get into the earlier stages of drug discovery, that's where it gets kind of interesting, right? So now you're moving into like the value dev stage, which is like a little bit in between. There's some direct academic collaboration, there's some spin outs. And we have a number of models there. One is that we call ITENs. They're basically integrated networks of academics. It's kind of somewhat DAO-like, but we pick an area that we're interested in, like say fatty liver disease, and we'll pull together like a consortium kind of academics that we're interested in, and they'll work kind of side by side with Pfizer scientists to try to move those ideas forward and translate them into potentially into drugs. Before that, I would say there's another model that we really pioneered. People refer to it as a open innovation model. So we have something called Centers for Therapeutic Innovation. And this is for academics that don't really understand drug discovery so well, but have interesting ideas to go in that direction. Don't really know like the venture crowd so well, so they can't just go out and tap someone from Third Rock, right? And like spin out a $100 million biotech. And so the way CTI works is we put a physical building in many of the bio hubs in the U.S. and some outside of the U.S. And the idea is that you have, so we'll put out like a request for a proposal, just like in our ITENs I described. It'll be focused in areas that we're interested in. And the academics will apply. And if we select their proposal, right, then their postdocs will come to our physical building. This is outside of Pfizer, right? It's its own building, right? And we send our scientists, and they work side by side, is the idea, with the academics focusing on the biology and assay development. And we do what we do best. Which is, developing the actual molecules, whether they're small molecules or antibodies. And we work to get into phase one. So we generate some human data. And then Pfizer typically has an option to buy whatever, we've developed together and bring it in-house. So now what's the pros and cons of that, right? So the pros are, if you're an academic and you don't understand drug discovery, well, now you've just worked side by side with Pfizer for X number of years, and you know how to do it yourself. And you probably even have some insight now into like who your investors are that would be to talk to if you want to do this yourself. The cons are we get this this option, right? It's like a pre-negotiated option when we start the project that says we can buy this for X amount of, you know, the terms are set ahead of time, which is not ideal, right? Like you really want to generate some interesting data in a hot area and have like a bidding war and have the VCs lined up to, you know, come in your company or the, you know, Pfizer's and BMS's term sheets to buy whatever you're doing. So it's not ideal to give away like an option that early. But if you need to learn how to do this, then it kind of makes sense. It's like the academic PI gets like good experience and you know, Pfizer gets to buy something with a little bit less risk. And we have a great example with a program that's in, it's just starting phase three. It's an interferon beta program in autoimmunity. And that came from, I think from the Brigham. And the PI there was exact phenotype I described in when we did the interferon beta program with him. We wound up optioning that, taking it in. And I ran into him in like 2019 or so, and he was starting his own company, which just raised a huge Series B, actually, a few months ago. But I said to him, I said, well, why don't you do CTI again? And he's like, well, you know, at the time, I didn't understand how to do drug discovery. So, you know, that helped me. But now I know how to do it. So, you know, why sign up for that? And he went out and he, you know, raised a standard Series A, and now they did the B. And, you know, hopefully it'll be successful. So,
yeah. Now, especially picking up on that tacit knowledge seems very, very important, which you really like, can't put into words, just being day by day in like a physical space in general with people who are like very experienced in traditional like pharma.
It's also like who you know is a big thing in the biotech world. Well, it's a small community in general, so everyone seems to be like one or two linkages away from everyone else. But that's really helpful in like getting people comfortable to invest, you know, multiple millions of dollars behind whoever you're working with. Because the people are just so important. The people are probably more important than the science itself. Yep.
Yeah, especially with like sub 10% of animal translation.
Yeah.
To check rates, like who makes the cat, I suppose. What do you wish you would have known when you first entered yourself, perhaps the biopharma industry?
Well, so my story is, when I finished grad school, I had an opportunity to start a biotech company. It's called Nexomics Biosciences, and they're still around at Princeton, New Jersey. So but they're more a CRO, contract research organization, right? So they provide services, for biotech and pharma companies. And, I didn't really understand the difference at the time between CRO business model and therapeutics business model. And that's what I wish I knew, right? So totally different investor set, totally different, you know, model for financing and advancing whatever you're working on. And I kind of came into the biotech world with the perception of what it was. And that perception was closer to therapeutics, right? Like that you're developing medicines for patients and you're gonna get in the clinic and, you know, all that stuff. But CRO work is more closer to like private equity. It's just all about generating profit, cash flows, right? And trying to sell those cash flows to the next investor. And so that became a little like disheartening for me. And that's actually why I left Nexomics and came to Pfizer to get closer to drug discovery. So.
Yeah. I always also like to ask about the sort of Chesterton's fences in my guest fields of work. That is the superficially unnecessary or broken elements of a given system that, in fact, actually serve hidden purposes, which are often maybe hard to glean from the outside of the industry. But would you say there's Chesterton fences for you in terms of traditional biotech that maybe now working together with a lot of like DeSci people, you kind of find yourself defending more and more?
Okay, hold on. Now you're going to have to educate me more on this. What is this, right? Chester's? I'm not familiar. So
it's a saying. So a philosopher kind of came up with the concept of this fence that is standing on a hillside, something like that. And it doesn't really seems to make sense to this guy who's just walking past and wants to do something with the land. And so the guy wants to take the fence away, but he is warned against that. He's warned against taking the fence away before understanding why the fence was put there in the first place, because maybe it's serving some function that isn't gleamable as an outsider kind of coming in immediately. But once the fence is put away, like that might have unintended consequences. Does that make sense?
I see.
Yeah. So what are like things that, you know, the fences in maybe traditional biopharma that if people on DSI could perhaps have their way would be removed? And maybe even in academia, I know you did a PhD. Like, are there just certain things that you feel like the benefits are underappreciated from the outside and they just look like burdens, but they might actually have unintended consequences if just pulled away?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I understand now. What is it called again?
Chesterton's fence.
Chesterton's fence. All right.
Yeah. After Chesterton.
Okay. So I think I have a good example here for this. I think in the DSI world, there's kind of a maybe unfair or mistrustful perception of the role that venture capital plays, and potentially even pharma also. You know, at the moment, pharma is, for the most part, like the buyer of these medicines from biotech. Like, that's the way our ecosystem works, right? Is you have academia, flows into biotech, for the most part, like some will go on to have commercial capability, but, you know, sells to pharma and pharma handles the sales. And that's the handoff along the way. And I think some people in DSI think that, and maybe they're right, but they think that that can be disrupted and that there isn't value along the way that's being added from the investor community and from, you know, pharma. So I think that if you just pulled that away and you said, we're going to blow the whole thing up and we're just going to have DSI, I think you'd run into a lot of problems with, you know, how the handoff works down the path of, you know, financing these projects and getting them to be approved products.
Yeah, that makes sense. So DSI being more participatory than traditional academia when it comes to funding research projects themselves, how do you think about maintaining scientific quality as general participation increases?
Yeah, so this is something we talk about a lot in VitaDAO, and it's also something that comes up like from the skeptics I talk to, like in the traditional kind of pharma biotech world. And so we found that the decentralized model, it works great for sourcing deals, for doing diligence. But then once you actually fund a project, you need someone to be accountable, right? Like the decentralized part doesn't work as well. And you know, the DAO purists and the decentralized purists will like throw their arms in the air and probably attack me on Twitter for saying that. But at the end of the day, it's like, you know, you just have to find what works here. And I think decentralization brings a lot of benefits, but we don't want to like throw out what works already from the traditional world. And so you have to have a point of contact that's, you know, there and like keeps the ship moving, is accountable to deadlines. Otherwise, it's just, you know, no one's responsible for anything and the money just goes into a black hole and you cross your fingers and hope something works. But I think to have success, you have to be proactive. So it's great. It is great. Decentralization, like I said, 10,000 people in VitaDAO, we have global stretch, right? In terms of seeing what's going on and people bringing great ideas. And again, global stretch in terms of being able to reach into people that can help due diligence. But after something's funded, you know, if we want to continue to add value, you can't just have like 10,000 people reaching out to a company or a PI saying, you know, how's this going? How's that going? We should do this. We should do that. You need someone to like kind of be you need a centralized person in a decentralized world that's kind of navigating the ship. So.
I like that, a centralized person in a decentralized world. Between you and the people you work with, this can extend now. I've kind of asked about DSI already, but is there just a general kind of topic that seems to repeat itself that's quite contentious among you and those that you do work with? Is there like a main disagreement that kind of like pops up repeatedly?
In the DAO world?
No, within the people that you work with, like at Pfizer, in the venture arm. And it can exceed even like the DAOs themselves.
Well, I mean, in terms of VitaDAO, I think we're all happy at Pfizer. And we have an excellent example of some strategic success, I'll call it. Well, we have. So our goals are strategic success and financial success, right? And I think we have both for VitaDAO. So we're happy. I mean, the token is worth more than what we bought it for. So we have financial success. And that's easy to quantitate. Strategic success is a little different, right? Like the ultimate strategic success would be there's something we're interested in, VitaDAO invested in it, and then Pfizer bought it, or Pfizer did a research collaborate. That would be the ultimate strategic success. We don't have that yet, but we have something close. One of the investments that VitaDAO just made is in a company called AcceptGen. And AcceptGen works on RNA for vaccines. They're working on a flu vaccine. And Pfizer was working with AcceptGen trying to evaluate their technology. And so they gave it to us, right? And we ran a few experiments on our end. And there's additional experiments, which we didn't really finance the project to run. And so VitaDAO actually, in parallel to this, invested in AcceptGen, and now AcceptGen has, you know, cash to run some of these additional de-risking experiments. So that's a great example of what we want to be doing. And the value that I try to communicate is, you know, this is an alternative pool of capital, and we can use it to help de-risk early science. It's so early that, like, you know, no one's going to be like stealing anything that early in the game. You rarely have like the actual patents that are going to be turned into the drugs at that point. So that's one example. And there's another one too, with a company that I'm pretty sure VitaDAO just invested in, or we had the positive vote. I don't know if the check has been written, but another longevity company that many have heard of called Gero. It's an AI company that has tools for working on target discovery. And we've been working on them in Pfizer separately of VitaDAO to help discover novel targets for fibrosis.
Great. Yeah. Is there any implicit knowledge kind of in the biopharma field that you find kind of holds true, but isn't necessarily explicitly stated for those that are just entering the field? Is there anything that has to be like learned anew through experience by everyone entering the field that doesn't really have a good reason to just be learned through, you know, like running into walls? Like, it could be written down, shared more publicly. It's kind of like unnecessarily tacit.
Well, it's, but I don't know, actually, I've only worked in the biopharma industry. But I, it was always a surprise to me. And actually, my experience in biopharma has been pretty broad. I started on the commercial side and then moved to R&D. And those are like two totally different worlds, right? But I was surprised how much you don't learn in school that prepares you for the drug discovery process and how they're sold, right? So how you make drugs, yeah, you may in grad school. And it's funny, grad school, it's like, you know, PhD is like pretty advanced degree, right? You learn about a very specific type of biology. Typically, it's very different from how drugs are made and the typical experiments that are run, you know, in the corporate setting. Maybe it's a little different now in academia, as like spinning out companies and having a commercial focus has become more acceptable. But in the past, you know, you didn't learn any of that stuff until you came to pharma. So it was almost like starting over again. And then on the commercial side too. So I have a PhD. So when I came to R&D, it was like, I had to learn again. I also have an MBA, right? And, when I started on the, commercial side of pharma, like nothing I learned in business school was really applicable to like the, how drugs are marketed and sold in the pharma world. You don't learn any of that stuff. You just have to start from scratch. So, yeah, I mean, I think your question was, what are the things that you don't learn that you should learn? And it's interesting. Learning is like a long process. And I think a lot of learning is just learning how to learn, right? I always tell my daughters this. It's like when you're in like high school and even like middle school, you're just learning like the discipline of how to structure your day and all that. You're not really learning anything specific. And in college, it's just an extension of that, right? Like you think you're learning something new, but you're still like learning what's in the textbook. You're really just learning how to be more independent. Like, I've had classes in college where the professor is just like, you know, the midterm is this date, the final is that date. If you want to come to class, come. If you don't, and some people don't come to class, right? And it's fine if you can read the book and teach yourself, because that's, in my view, that's what you're learning. You're learning how to learn. And then grad school is a little different because you run out of textbook and your job is to write the next chapter of the textbook that hasn't been written yet. So you do have to add something new and learn, but it's like so specialized and focused that once you get out into the work world, I think there's just a whole nother set of, you know, rules that need to be learned and how to actually like generate something that's valuable.
Mm, yeah, yeah. It's two different, totally different
pieces. That was philosophical. Yeah.
Have there been, in your own experience, like particular challenges that have time and again kind of haunted you throughout your career, like some structural challenge, for example, that keeps reappearing? Is there like some through line in terms of what you're trying to work on?
I just think that, you know, as you kind of move up the chain in terms of like experience, eventually, you know, like you kind of weed out the people that don't really fully understand, you know, what they're doing, or, you know, aren't as focused as others. And you get to the point where like everyone is super highly qualified. So then how do you really separate, you know, talent and ideas from each other? It becomes challenging. It becomes a little bit difficult. It's also a great feeling when you're kind of working with like people you feel that are like, everyone's like a strong expert. So there's pros and cons. It's like, on one hand, you kind of hit a ceiling where you're like, okay, you know, how do I kind of keep my career moving forward? But on the other hand, it's nice to like know that the people standing next to you are like super expert, and you can trust them for everything. So
yeah,
that's kind of where I am at. And I don't know, I guess, yeah, who knows what's next.
Yeah. How have you found, I mean, maybe this is like, you know, asking about some decision that will be made in the future and that's relevant, but how have you found to kind of select between different ideas among a level where you know that, you know, those ideas are all sound, there's no obvious like wrongs with them? Is it intuition, just like kind of the happenstance of what you know more about in terms of research areas? Like, how does one actually then kind of choose between different ideas?
Yeah, I think we have something going on internally now at Pfizer that is a perfect example for this. And I can't name the companies, but we're looking at an area of science. And there's a few companies that we're kind of like evaluating in parallel. And they all kind of do this similar thing. And they're all like just grading out as very similar, to the point where it's like there isn't enough data now to really be able to differentiate them until we see what happens in humans. So what do you do, right? Like, that's what you're asking, basically. And I think that's where what I was saying earlier is it's kind of like who you know and the trust and credibility of team comes in. And I think ultimately that becomes the differentiator. When you have two really high profile teams, it becomes difficult. But then that's where maybe some personal relationships come in or track record. And so, yeah, I think that it has to just elevate from the technical qualifications into the people level.
Yeah, makes sense. Lastly, I suppose, can you think of any important questions that I have not asked you today? Anything that you really want to address that hasn't really been raised?
Yeah, I guess so I ask you the question, or I have to ask myself a question?
No. Kind of like, what do I know that I don't know? What's like something that has been on your mind that you just want to kind of raise?
Yeah, I worry about a few things. I worry about DAOs being able to generate value before the bank runs out, right? So the DAO bank, right? Like, so I think we'll be able to go out and raise another round of capital here, at least within VitaDAO, no problem. But we need to have a win. These wins we were talking about, right? We already kind of defined what they are. But life science is long. It's a long process, right? Like it could easily be that one of these projects that we financed needs another round of pre-venture funding, which is another 1 to 2 years to get it to the point where it can graduate into a venture type deal. And, you know, life science investors are used to this, but from my, you know, limited experience here operating in both worlds, like the Web3 investors are not, right? And so at some point, this is going to come to a bigger head. It hasn't yet, but at some point it's going to, unless we get lucky and like something like hits and moves on quickly to the next stage, and then, you know, money just flows in. But, you know, the economies of the world are like all in a tough spot at the moment across all areas, like investment capital is drying up. And that's the thing that I worry most about is can we really, you know, generate something valuable that can graduate into venture capital or have a collaboration with a big pharma company or a biotech company sooner than later?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. This was really interesting.
Yeah, good stuff. So happy to be here. And thank you.
Thank you.
All right.